I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today is a very special episode of the Political Theory Review, as it is the 50th. I decided to honor the occasion, after all the political theory we've discussed here, to go back to a basic question. What is it that we're doing here? What is political theory? To help me answer these questions and to celebrate, I'm talking today to Jeannie Moorfield, senior lecturer in political theory at the University of Birmingham and co-president of the Association for Political Theory. Moorfield works on the political theory of empire, theories of international relations, and is the author of several noted books and articles. Also on is Ryan Hanley, professor of political science at Boston College. Hanley works on the history of modern political thought, theories of love and virtue, and is also the author of several notable books and articles. So first of all, let me say to Ryan Hanley and Jeannie Moorfield, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Hello, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Good to be here.
So this is a little bit of an unusual episode. It's a special one because it's amazing that this is the 50th episode I've done, which is pretty amazing. And so I've invited on two very great political theorists to talk about the big question of our discipline, which is, what is political theory? And I wanted to just start off by addressing that question directly and posing it to both of you. So the general question is, what is political theory? What are its aims, its subject matter, and methods? That's the kind of general guiding question. And let me say, just as a matter of, I usually ask people at the beginning of the conversation, what's their motivation for writing the book? But I should say a little bit about my motivation for asking this question, because it might come a little bit out of the blue. I mean, there's a sort of simple answer to it, which is I tend to get questions from students, either graduate students or undergraduate students, about this very question, which is, what actually is political theory? Students can sometimes say, well, I can get a handle on what political philosophy is, but what's that? What's the difference between that and political theory? Or what's the difference between you and what your colleagues in political science do, for instance? And so one of my frustrations is that I've never been able to really get a good answer to that, even to students, which is a little bit embarrassing. So here's an opportunity to get a good answer from the two of you. But also, I think more generally and systematically, as a matter of thinking about the field, I think it's generally good for any field to ask, to return to kind of fundamental principles and ask the fundamental questions about the nature of what we're doing. I think that's good for any field, but I think it's also in particular good for us as political theorists, because we have such a pluralistic field. It's a little bit unusual in the sense when I've had interactions with colleagues in other disciplines, and they're often amazed by how many different kinds of approaches and methods that we have. And so that it makes this question particularly difficult, I think, in our case, to say much of anything substantive about the field as a whole. But I think so it's important to try to, I think, figure out what's common to all these different approaches in our field. But it's also very difficult. So that's why I have on two smart people to help talk about this. So I guess over to you. What is political theory? I'll take my prerogative and call on one of you, so I don't have to. I flipped a coin, and Jeannie, you're up first.
You didn't flip a coin. There was no coin. I really tend to feel that the fact that you can't answer that for your students is actually what makes political theory great. I think the fact that we resist in some pretty fundamental ways that the attempts over the years to kind of enclose theory in a set of methodological concerns or substantive issues or conceptual kind of parameters, the fact that we resist that is actually kind of what makes us quirky and great as a subfield. And it's what allows us to avoid what I think are really toxic methodological wars that we see our colleagues in political science get into, for instance, between quantitative and qualitative folks. And many of us have watched that play out in departments over the years. At the same time, I don't want to say that there's, so I resist the move to closure to say, oh God, I have no idea what that is, but I resist the move to closure. So I sort of resist the idea that we're putting up walls and trying to figure out what we are. But at the same time, I also want to say there is something special about what we do, right? So I kind of want it both ways. And I want to say that because I've also been in situations where I've seen people in political science kind of colonize what we do by saying, aren't we all theorists now? Mm-hmm. And I want to say, well, no, you're not. But I struggle to find a reason why not. So I think it's the puzzle or the tension coupled with the really interesting plurality of conceptual approaches that make political theory what it is, that make us, to my mind, more interesting and open than political philosophy in some ways. I think it creates conflicts, certainly, but it also creates kind of radical openings. If there was one thing that I had to say we all tend to do, we all seem to be interested in language in ways which are more flexible and more interesting, I would, well, that's my bias, obviously, than political scientists. But other than that, I'm not entirely sure. Ryan, what do you think? I don't know. I just threw out this tension-holding bombshell. So
No, that's great. I love the way the question's framed as a question from a curious undergraduate, right? How do you relate it to your students?
Exactly, yeah.
And I think that that's great because in the first place, I mean, it obviates or puts to the side the sort of what Jeannie, I think, is rightly called the toxic methodological struggles. And we have those, of course, not just within quantitative social science, but, you know, even in the world, I work at the intersection of the history of philosophy, the history of political thought, the history of political theory. Those things all mean different things to different people, and those methodological wars can get toxic. But I think that sort of prior to all of that, the advantage of talking in terms of political theory first and foremost, and especially talking to undergraduates and teaching political theory, the significance of the concept of what it means to theorize. And, you know, usually this comes up when I teach my grand surveys, as we all do, ancients to moderns. And we're talking about what especially the ancient Greeks thought they were up to when they were theorizing. And we know that the derivation of the word from theoria, the idea of seeing in a certain way, to be a spectator. And I think that, that's the value we add as political theorists, which is the capacity to be able to step back, to see the political world, to try and understand and to perceive political realities in a way that's perhaps fundamentally different from the way in which either those on a more advocacy level and practical politics might, or even in the application of certain quantitative methodologies in the ways that our scholarly colleagues might. So I think that is in many ways what makes the discipline unique, what makes it fun to teach to students, the idea of being able to step back and to try and to see in the broadest way, to spectate and to understand the different political phenomena of our world before us.
Yeah, can I just add one thing to that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really agree, although I would resist the idea that there is a place from which we theorize. I think if anything, again, the plurality of our discipline, and particularly the push toward anti-colonial, differing conceptions of modernity, would all sort of push in a direction which opened up the place from which we see to a multiplicity of perspectives. So I think you're right that the attempting to see and to draw conclusions is there, but I would just, the one thing I would do is resist the idea that there is a place from which we do that.
Yeah, do either of you know where sort of, I mean, I'm thinking just historically now as a matter of genealogy of our own discipline, when we started to use the term political theory? I mean, of course, Hannah Arendt, you know, famously talks about, you know, that she's not a philosopher, but she's a political theorist. Not, you know, those of you who know Hannah Arendt maybe can tell tell me what that actually means or what the significance of that is. But at least, you know, there, I guess one way to think about this question is to think about it genealogically, right? Not to think about some kind of substance or essence, but to think about the way the different schools are developed. And so maybe, you know, instead of, I was going to throw out to you a couple different schools, but I didn't know if you, either of you had any insight on where, you know, historically we started to develop this kind of language of political theory as opposed to, say, political philosophy.
Well, I mean, in the I don't know, Brian, you know the historical word, but like Harold Laski in the teens and 20s was calling himself a political theorist to distinguish himself from political philosophers. And he was at the LSC, and so he was in a school that aligned itself with the study of politics explicitly and also was engaged with the world. So I don't know if that's where for his sensibilities originated, but there was some sense that what he was doing was different from philosophy. And then there's these, you know, methodological surveys that suggest that it's after World War II that you get the emergence of political theory as a discrete field within political science, and that it develops as political scientists sort of let go of questions they used to ask prior to World War II, which are ethical questions. And certainly there was much more broad-ranging movement between what we now call the subdisciplines before then. But we kind of got hived off into the space where you asked those questions because political scientists weren't anymore. So that's...
Right.
Yeah,
do I have the basic thumbnail history right? That basically in the early 20th century, you have this positivist turn, which takes hold of many different fields, philosophy and political science included, where political science, you have a sort of behaviorist turn, which tries to bracket some of these broader questions. And of course, you see this in philosophy too, where the attempt is to sort of render these questions meaningless or insignificant. And so that opened up a space, I think, in both fields for this sort of development of this.
Yeah, I don't know the 20th century history, I have to say. I've been thinking about some of the ways 18th century universities were organized and where it may have come from. But I think the interesting point that comes out from what you both just said is the degree to which the subfield in which we practice seems to be an artifact of the 20th century's sociology of knowledge. And that is something that I think a lot of us sort of wrestle with now as we think about where our natural home is. I'd be curious to hear from both of you, but a lot of my interlocutors are, of course, historians of philosophy and philosophy departments, because I work on Adam Smith, economists, although there's fewer and fewer historians of economics and economic thought. You know, I think that we are living with, and maybe this will get us into larger questions about the state of where we stand now as a subfield within the larger discipline of political science. But I think in many ways we've inherited, because of that sociology of knowledge, a position within a political science department that I'd like to think can be healthy and that it has a future and a robust future. But I'm also well aware that there are skeptics out there. And I think it's important for us to think in terms, given the legacy that has been bequeathed to us and the places that we occupy, the ways in which our connections, to the degree that they're natural to the other subfields of political science that we have before us, and the degree to which perhaps certain connections outside of political science may be even, depending upon the type of theory we do, even more natural.
Yes, let's talk about those relationships, I think, to some of the other fields, because that's another question that I sort of posed to the two of you in preparation for this. And one way to think about what this discipline is to think about its relationship to other fields and disciplines. And indeed, this is another, I think, distinctive feature about political theory is that it's very interdisciplinary in a way that a lot of other fields are sometimes siloed off from other fields. And so I'm curious about your views about the relationship, say, between political theory and political science within our broader discipline. But also there are many, many ways in which political theory is connected to philosophy. but not just philosophy, but history, cultural studies, economics. So what's your sense?
Do you want to go, Ryan? You were just talking about the connection to history. I'd love to hear more.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of facing this on a very practical level right now, which is having just made this move to Boston, which has such a wonderful intellectual community. We're trying to launch we don't have the acronym down yet. I'm still up for suggestions, but something like a Boston Area Enlightenment Studies Network. And so it's interesting as we find the tremendous resources of people that work across fields on 18th century topics. The ways in which we might coalesce and the sorts of questions we might coalesce around, because there are very different ways of understanding what is foundationally important and what defines both Enlightenment, but the 18th century more generally. And I'm curious to see how this evolves, because it's been interesting to see the number of people that are interested in core political questions that are drawn to this. But we also have a number of people interested in questions of material culture, questions of epistemology from early modern historians of philosophy. And so we're going to have quite a diverse range of perspectives. But I get the sense that a remarkable number of the people that seem to be drawn to this do have specifically political, and I mean that not in any sort of highfalutin sense, but some basic political interests that they're working towards. And so in some ways, because the political experience is so common to all of us in our capacity as citizens, I wonder if that isn't the place that this interdisciplinary group might end up coalescing around. It remains to be seen. But aside from my own sort of idiosyncratic personal interest with that little group, I think this is the other thing that I find to be pressing, I suppose is the right way to put this, in terms of not our relationship necessarily with other fields outside, which I engage in and I think is important, but how are the space that we occupy within political science departments. And I have some trepidations about the future, just given for a variety of reasons that go from demographics and the finances of universities to the ways in which we have even articulated some of our own interests as political theorists. But the idea that I think in the same way that the 18th century group that I'm organizing may have the potential to coalesce around real politics, I think that is a side of, should we say, the divide, the bifurcation between quantitative social science and political theory as we practice it today, that I'm hoping we're seeing, I think, helpful signs of this narrowing, and perhaps that might be a trend that will continue in the future. I take some of this from the good fortune of having attended APT meetings where people are interested in questions of political realism and such things. So Jeannie, with that, I'll give to you to see from your perspective. And I'd be curious to hear, I don't want to put you on the spot as APT, is a co-president? I want to make sure I have the title right. I thought so. But it seems to me that if there is indeed a move generally within contemporary political theory to questions of, to use the term that I still associate personally with Ray Goyce, of quote-unquote real politics, if that might not provide us some hopeful opportunities of bridging a methodological divide with the other subfields that I think has become really dangerous and potentially pernicious as we move forward.
I think it's interesting. I mean, I think there's a way that the times are compelling us toward this, right? So in my own experience as someone who straddles, like you, history, political theory, history, but also international politics and the history of international ideas. And I'm watching more and more of my IR colleagues struggle with, well, then, you know, with Trump, what is the liberal world order? What are the assumptions we've been making about states? What are the assumptions? And the realists, too, are really struggling to find what makes sense in an international context, given a world that doesn't seem to make sense anymore. And I have found so many brilliant interlocutors in IR in particular lately, people really doing more historical work than I've ever seen, really questioning fundamental assumptions, that, for instance, that the United States is not an empire. This is no longer the fundamental assumption of many of people working in IR. And so I think there's a way that our porousness to toward other subfields, toward, again, to language, ideology, discourse, our conceptual abilities to put things together, arguments that go beyond kind of, I don't know, positivist or even, you know, your average quantitative analysis or qualitative analysis in political science. I think our capacity to do that is actually a resource for other for people in the discipline. I realize that I'm in England, and now actually it's easier in a way here because the discipline isn't as fraught in most British departments as it is, with some key ones aside, that as it is in the U.S. But at the same time, I'm really noticing this. So I went to a history workshop and I gave a talk at an IR thing, and I'm doing a theory thing, and I sort of feel like increasingly my fingers are in puddles, like where I'm not the one who's doing all the work to bring it all together. I feel like that coming together is happening, and I'm a part of it and helping it along. I think that's a good sign for us.
Yeah, that's encouraging to hear. I'm in a very quantitative methods heavy department, and I find this relationship difficult to bridge. I mean, my colleagues like me, and they're happy to have me in the department. Oh, well, thank you. But they like me because I publish stuff, so that helps with our rankings, I suppose. But they have no idea what I do, and they have zero interest in finding it out. And so I'm part of my puzzle with this is to. I mean, this is sort of a separate question than the issue, but is the, you know, how that bridge can be made between political theory and political science. I had a PhD student a couple of years ago who was a real methods whiz and happened to be a theorist, and we tried to co-author a couple papers that tried to bridge this gap, and we used data, and he was the data guy, and I, you know, the theory, and it was soundly rejected by journals, because it's just, you know, it was either reviewed by a theorist who hated the idea of having methods, or it was reviewed by a methods person who hated, you know, so in a way, I mean, this is an old story about the specialization of the disciplines, especially the specialization of the quantitative side of things, that it just becomes very difficult to sort of have any input from the outside.
So that seems to me absolutely right. And first of all, kudos to you for trying to bridge in that particular way. Maybe you and that student will persist with that paper. But, you know, there might be different ways to bridge. I mean, you mention the undeniable fact of hyper-specialization. And it's simply true that we have develop such sophisticated techniques and such voluminous amounts of scholarship that I'm sure my quantitative colleagues no more expect me to master their methods than I expect them to master the vast secondary literature on late 17th century French theological disputes. So at some sort of like the end point, I think it's going to be very hard for us downstream, as it were, to come together. But my hope, actually, and this is why I mentioned sort of that realist turn, and not simply in terms of IR realism, but the move away from ideal theorizing, and the move to real politics, is that hopefully what animates my scholars and my colleagues who are more quantitative, and certainly I think much of the best work in political theory now, is not downstream trying to come together, but a concern for the sorts of questions that are being raised by the age, the politically pressing. Mm-hmm. And since Jeannie put the T word on the table, whatever else one may say about Mr. Trump, and there's, of course, much to be said, he's been a good thing for political theorists. Mm-hmm. As, quite simply, the stakes have been raised as to what some dramatically important and pressing political concerns are, and being able to understand and have a vocabulary and the conceptual precision to be able to define what some of the issues and problems are. Mm-hmm. And so I do see, actually, and so, you know, Jeannie, you were mentioning things in sort of IR theory and sort of the questions of the liberal world order. I mean, for me, as an Adam Smith guy, you know, we're in a time of very creative rethinking as we come into the Democratic primaries for 2020 of exactly what capitalism is. And that civic discussion that's happening there is also happening among my friends in economics departments, is certainly happening among my friends that do IPE in our department and other departments. And for those of us that are engaged in questions in the history of economic thought, this is really exciting to take as a point of a real practical issue in contemporary politics, the future of our capitalist system, and in what fundamental ways it may need to be changed. This opens up all kinds of possibilities for, I think, recovering the richness, not just of different contemporary theoretical traditions, but going back to what I still think of as a lost history. I mean, Smith is hardly an unknown man, but there's a lot in Smith that remains unknown. And so I think having this moment, in some ways, again, people will say whatever they want to say about Trump, but there's something energizing about it insofar as the political stakes have been raised high and the motivations to do serious work and to understand some of the issues is similarly high right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really glad you raised that too, because it also gets sort of to your question, that another question that you were thinking about, Jeff, which is the importance of history. Mm-hmm. And I love this about Smith, because every time I teach Smith, and my students, that we read about the invisible hand, but then we also read about the necessary public funding of roads and bridges. You know, we also read about taxation, which is all very different than the kind of, I don't know, Luddite version that you get, right, from the Adam Smith Society, right? There's a way in which that Smith himself had a richer understanding of capitalism than Milton Friedman. So, like, there's a way that studying history helps, you know, disclose those possibilities. And Quentin Skinner has a line about opening up the horizons of the possible. And I think that Smith's a great case there.
Yeah, and I think the Trump example is a good one because, I mean, I'm not the first one to notice that there's a kind of epical shift that seems to be going on, not simply because of him, but it seems like the landscape is being transformed politically in not just with political parties, but with a whole different introduction of new kinds of isms. You know, so the study of populism, for instance, can stretch across both political theory and into political science. And so, I mean, maybe there's one reason I think why Trump is so useful for political theorists is because, these kinds of epical shifts, I think, are our game, as it were, because it's a moment when, you know, it's not the usual day-to-day affairs of politics that are salient, which our colleagues can really nail down with quite a rigor, but it's that the fundamental issues are changing and shifting, and that requires a wider lens of seeing, as you said at the beginning, Ryan. So I do think that's right. I mean, I think there are some issues I think that are being raised in the contemporary era that are really moved. The other example that I was thinking of was the deliberative democracy movement, which is really being, you know, it's moved from theory to practice now in many different ways. There are lots of ways in which that's being piloted in various places. I talked to Jim Fishkin a couple weeks ago about his book, which is really has a little bit of theory, but it's mostly about the empirics that are involved in sort of testing the efficacy of deliberative democracy and its effects. And so there's a lot. My colleague here, Ryan Kennedy, works on deliberative democracy, you know, the empirical study of it. And so there are several ways, I think, in which this, you know, there in particular questions, we can find some overlap. I guess the other example, maybe one final example I'll use, which I've found useful, and maybe this goes to the Smith point too, which is we have an American politics guy who works on political psychology, and I found that field in particular has a lot of overlap with political theory, because insofar as it touches on, you know, Jonathan Haidt and this sort of, moral foundations theory. It's making certain claims about human nature. It's using experimental methods, which I like because it tries to get at human nature. And it raises some of these, you know, bread and butter political theory issues about human nature that you can get some traction on. Good. Let's see. Where should we go next?
Can I also?
Yeah.
I think there's also a way So I think it took a long time for political theorists to develop an interest in imperialism and postcolonialism. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Pitts has that wonderful review essay in 2010 where she says, look, we people in history, comparative literature, cultural studies were doing this for 20 years before we got interested in it. And I think part of how we were so slow, I think in part, and this is maybe one of the negative impacts of being associated with political science, because we're really saddled to a discipline which has historically taken sovereignty and state sovereignty very, very seriously. And to be able to think about imperialism requires challenging the sort of cultural, political, economic boundaries of sovereignty and the discursive boundaries of sovereignty in new, really new ways that, again, also harken back to history. And so I think one of the other things that we can do as we become more interested in these questions is, and this has led to this sort of flowering of interest in alternative cosmopolitanisms. I think you talked to Inez Valdez about her new book, right, there, and Adam Getachew. There's a way in which we can help model for political science. I said model and political science. we can help like what a more capacious and worldly understanding of human politics, not bound by sort of or enclosed by sovereignty, might look like and has looked like.
I think that it is indeed one of the most exciting things that's happening in political theory. I was just sent and just began reading this morning. I have to review Martha Nussbaum's new book on the traditions of cosmopolitanism. And that's been a work in gestation for 20 years, she says, in the book. But clearly, this speaks to these sorts of concerns that have been longstanding. And I'm very struck, Jeannie, in the way I think you rightly say, that in some ways, of course, Nussbaum's writing as a philosopher, but political theorists sometimes have come sort of late to the game on some questions. And that's a danger, and it's interesting to hear you identify that. I also wonder, and again, having put the T word out on the table, and having myself defended the idea that it's good that political theory on some level takes some of our cues from contemporary politics, I also recognize there's a danger in both being late to the game, but also being too quick on the draw. And so I worry a little bit, and I thought about this especially when, I think it was Andrew Sullivan published the piece, and I don't know where, maybe it was Atlantic, but it was the one on essentially Trump and Republic 8 and 9 on the question of, you know, did Plato predict tyranny of some sort? And so I think that at the same time that we take some of our cues from real politics, we also do have to resist some of these temptations to move too quickly, especially as a historian of political thought. I think we have to realize that there's both conceptual nuance as well as historical difference. So in some ways, putting the brakes sometimes on some of the connections is as useful as being even quicker on the draw here.
No, I totally agree. And I Edward Said had a lovely idea he called slow humanism, which was just that it is necessary for political and intellectual life to put the brakes on sometimes and do the kinds of reflection that, you know, that reveal the present more fully. And I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, so I think maybe this is a good place to turn to, which is maybe some major themes in the field, just to talk about them and maybe the ways in which political theory has been able to contribute in some ways. We've already been talking about the, say the realist turn, which stretches both from political theory but also into philosophy. I'm interested, Jeannie, in maybe if you could expand a little bit on your sense of how the field has contributed on some of these issues about cosmopolitanism and about international issues around empire. Because my sense is, you know, Nussbaum and the philosophical literature on cosmopolitanism has really been a great service in introducing a lot of issues around global justice. The long trend of Rawls and the sort of neo-Kantian tradition has been great in introducing a kind of moral language with that. But I think political theory also has been challenging that sort of approach recently. And so maybe we could talk about that briefly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. So Martin White, who's one of the, you know, great IR thinkers of the 20th century, had this piece in 1960, I believe, and it said, "Why is there no international theory?" And he said, "Well, there's no international theory because theory is concerned with normative issues, and we are concerned with the messy fringes around states and international politics, and we are in there with the, you know, the guts and glory, and political theory is internal looking." And interestingly, it took a long time for people to move out of that. And in the 70s, when they did, and Sam Moyne has written about this, and Katrina Forrester's new book about this, and I think Michael Goodhart's book covers some of this, there was a move to expand political theory to think more about global politics. But they did so pretty specifically within the register of normative concerns, or was an analytical register. So it might have been a sort of either Rawlsian laws of people, law of peoples, or, you know, more social Rawlsians like Bites. But it still was on that register, and that was pretty predominant in the field amongst Nussbaum as part of this. There was a Hage, this whole cadre of folks thinking along these lines really dominated the people in political theory, or the way political theorists thought about the rest of the world, until, I would say, very recently. And I think it's come out of the turn to empire. So the turn to empire, which I think we can say sort of starts out with Uda Mehta and then Jennifer Pitts and Sankar Muthu and Duncan Bell and all these people who have done such great work historically, it sort of opened things up for people to ask broader questions about the relationship between the global South and the global North, the non-West and the West, however we're going to call it, history and contemporary politics, culture, all of that is, I think, leading to this moment where people are starting to question the kind of normative edge that has kept political theorists out of global theorizing, if that makes sense. And so I was really lucky to be part of this great edited volume that Duncan Bell put together with Peggy Cohn and Inez and Charles Mills and Sam Moyne and Indra Marwa. It's called Empire, Race, and Global Justice. And I think it might be the first edited volume that really starts to take on these questions about the sort of limitations of both the normative approach to, which is not to say that there is nothing great to be gotten from there, but that it has been the only game in town for a long time. And to sort of start to question, for me, and I'll stop in a minute, I realize I'm going on, but what Said, to introduce what Said, again, and I'm a scholar, I'm writing a book on Edward Said, right, so it's in my head a lot, would call a contrapuntal approach to politics and history, to think about the presence of the past, and in particular the presence of the imperial past, to think about that in ways which both call into question the kind of, you know, homogeneous we that theorizes, that even through cosmopolitan theory, that asks broader questions about alternative forms of cosmopolitanism. Inez's book is really great on that, and Rethinking Du Bois. Adam Getachew's book is really great on that, rethinking anti-colonial ideas of world making. So I think there's ways in which we are now thinking, and if I can say this more broadly, and I just used a we, but political theory is more worldly than it was, if that makes sense, which is also a Saidian term. And that's the sense that people really are engaging politics and history through anti-colonial engagements with settler colonialism, sort of subjects and conceptual lenses that challenge that normative global divide.
Yeah, one of the things that sort of struck me actually as you were developing that. And it seems to me right that that is in many ways a very recent development, this way of thinking beyond the state within contemporary political theory. But the number of scholars that you cited, Jeannie, there are also happen to be very fine 18th century scholars. And so, you know, Sankarmuthu, Jennifer Pitts, among others that you mentioned, in many ways, their move to do this kind of theorizing is a move back to the 18th century and to some degrees a recovery. And so I hate to be the guy that sort of champions the Enlightenment and says, no, I don't hate to be that guy. I'll have to.
Don't be that guy.
Yeah.
But in this particular sense, this is what seems to us a very recent move, is a way that is a move that, as Sankar and Jennifer and others have shown, is a move that's foundationally, or at least the conceptual foundations are laid, if imperfectly developed, within certain 18th century theorists. So all these concerns about due commerce and the effects of globalized commerce, questions of universal human rights, questions of the institutions that construct perpetual peace. I mean, these are the bread and butter, as we know, of canonical Enlightenment theory. And I think that while in many ways the modalities are different and the way these questions are developed in the 18th century, what's new for us is, in fact, simultaneously a recovery of something that is also comparatively very old. And I think that that's important to remember because it reminds us of the importance of historicity, even within our own discipline and our own subfield. And so we've been talking a little bit to now about sort of the divide between quantitative social science and political science and political theory. But I think this is also another aspect of the question that's of interest to people, especially like Jeannie and myself, but I think to a more broad spectrum of political theorists. Almost all of us teach something like the history of political theory. And so whether we're doing research or simply in our capacity as scholars, that question of how the history and the contemporary practice of theorizing match up or don't match up, I think is also an important part of this conversation. And it was just, the table was laid for that particular move by this nice reminder of how much of that new motivation within thinking about anti-imperialism comes from a resuscitation or a return to certain 18th century ideas.
Yeah, and I want to, Ryan, in a few minutes, ask you specifically about history of political thought and its status and the kinds of questions there. You raise a good question, though, which is I take it the question of the status of the Enlightenment in contemporary political theory, which I think you're right that, say, yeah, Sankarmuthu and Jennifer Pitts, they want to recover in some ways some parts of the Enlightenment, although they're... I also get the sense that that this question is still somewhat unsettled. I mean, there's still an Enlightenment and its critics. What do you think, Jeannie?
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly the work on the uncomfortable relationship between Enlightenment thought and imperialism, sort of not just politically but epistemologically, makes me a little uncomfortable saying this is an Enlightenment project, it's interesting too that many people who do work on imperialism, who are also champions of a particular kind of perpetual peace, so Anthony Pagden in particular, will often hearken back to the Enlightenment and then just not deal with like all of that first half of the 20th century, when a lot and the late 19th century, right at the time when that moment of high imperialism, when you know all kinds of particular justificatory moves were made in the name of a kind of human progress. So my historical inclinations are always about sort of doing fine-grained work on the institutional evolution of ideas in context, as someone who studies the early 20th century, really digging into those contexts. And a lot of really interesting things happened during that period which have resonances with the kind of Enlightenment logic, and they are complicating and lead to what are, you know, at the end of the day, some pretty deep global hierarchies. So I guess I would resist saying it's an Enlightenment project. At the same time, I want to honor that desire to see in, and I believe that there were clearly anti-imperial Enlightenment thinkers, right? So that that we can find in the Enlightenment both of these, and being able to keep the both of them up in the air as just part of what it means to think about the Enlightenment, I think is important.
Yeah, that's good. I have to say there are two scholarly debates that I try and stay away from as far as possible, because I see so little opportunity for genuine headway. One is on Das Adam Smith Problem, and the other is the Enlightenment Project.
Yeah.
I mean, it elicits such powerful feelings that go back into very familiar debates that we all know from the mid part of the century. I think, you know, but Jeannie, I think, is right to point out that you said, I think that your instinct is to go towards a more fine-grained approach, fine-grained contextualism. And I think that here's a place where things are more beneficial than ever. I mean, as a specialist in 18th century political thought, one of the most exciting things that's happening now is the way in which we're rethinking the concept of the Enlightenment and I'll be very reductive here, the question of who's in and who's out. And so not just on questions of imperialism, there's obviously many, quote unquote, Enlightenment thinkers on different sides of that divide. But also, we're seeing all kinds of ways that have progressed far beyond the sort of very simplistic reduction down to Voltaire and the critiques of the church and these sorts of things, with regard especially to rethinking the place of religion within Enlightenment. So there's really creative ways in which the Enlightenment canon is being expanded by specialists, not just in political theory, but all over the disciplinary map here. And so I'm hoping that some of that might help us get beyond what have been some very entrenched and very debates that elicit some deep feelings on both sides of the divide.
But. Yeah, it seems we've certainly, I think, moved beyond. I mean, there's the old debate between the Enlightenment and the counter-Enlightenment, I think, as Isaiah Berlin used to call it. And that seems to me to have gone by the wayside, in part because...
One would wish, yeah. But then...
And it's still alive, is it? Okay.
Steven Pinker publishes...
Oh, right, right, of course,
Enlightenment
yeah.
Now.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it reintroduces this old thing. Charles Taylor used to call it the boosters and the knockers.
And, right, right.
Now we've got a bestseller that is taking one side and resuscitating some things. I won't say more about Pinker now.
But it strikes me that, I mean, essentially what you're saying, I mean, because I've often thought this about, say, the so-called counter-Enlightenment, where there are figures like, well, like Herder, for instance. I mean, it's just not even at all clear that it's, you know, appropriate or useful to classify a figure like that in something called the counter-Enlightenment, because it takes such a global approach to what the Enlightenment is. I mean, he had some issues with some trends in a sort of 18th century rationalism, but what he was trying to do was to try to improve that tradition. He was a humanist, right? And so, I mean, is that the kind of sense that you have, Ryan, that what's going on is to try to, you know, break the concept down into different debates within the Enlightenment and to see the Enlightenment as a more pluralistic movement rather than as something that's homogenous?
Yeah, like any movement or any ism, I mean, the sort of the devil's in the details, but also all the interesting stuff is in the details.
Yeah.
I do think that, and we have to call it a construct, I think the construct of the concept of Enlightenment is far from useless. And so, for example, I do think that Berlin was onto something with the concept of the counter-Enlightenment. And that was really even, I mean, Berlin was a good historian, I will say, but more recent historians, I think of Darren McMahon now at Dartmouth, wrote a wonderful book on the enemies of Enlightenment, where he really shows that there were people that self-identified in the mid-18th century as very consciously trying to reject a frame of the day. So there are currents that can be understood within these broad categories. But there are also other ways in which some of the most interesting cases are genuinely subversive of the conventional divides that we've grown up with and been educated in. Jean mentioned that her work in progress on Said. I've been working in progress on a thinker who is all but unknown today, except for those who have read their Emile and know that there's an offhand reference to this guy, François Fenelon. But Fenelon was an astoundingly influential figure throughout the 18th century, the best-selling book in all of 18th century France after the Bible is written by Fenelon. Mm-hmm. You can still go to the Parthenon today in Paris and see him up on the pediment with all the heroes of the revolution. Mm-hmm. And so, look, a Catholic archbishop who had deep-seated theological concerns that seem as far removed from Voltaire and the whole crowd as possible was at the same time embraced by the ones that anyone would consider on any definition squarely within the Enlightenment pre-revolutionary perspective. So that's, I think, an example of simply how the categories can be helpful points of departure and can illuminate some figures, but often most of the most interesting work comes from these subversions and looking at the exceptions to the rule, or at least I hope in the case of Fenelon.
Yeah. So can I take a step back to ask about the history of political thought, because it's an important current in political theory, and to ask a couple questions about it. I mean, one is the question of just, you know, what's the point about sometimes is again from the undergraduate perspective.
Your undergraduate student again.
There. Yes, I'm channel. I should have one in the room with me here, but I don't. You know, why look back to these dusty debates? What's the use of studying the history of political thought? And I mean, the second related question we'll get there is the question of the canon in because traditionally we've appealed to a certain canon. Ryan, you say, you know, you teach a class on the ancients and the moderns, and so this question I'm sure has come up about how to think about the history of political thought is if there is a tradition or if, you know, how to think about the marginal figures, say, in that tradition. So maybe we could start about, you know, how we think about the purpose of studying history. Why don't we just all become contemporary political philosophers?
Ryan, I know you have stuff to say about that.
Uh-oh, I'm going down the rabbit hole now here, so we're going to have to cut me off as the host here, Jeff.
Okay.
Let me start with a brief and opening comment. And actually, it goes back to something that Jeannie said very early on, which is the sort of perspective from which we do our seeing of the contemporary world and contemporary politics. I mean, one of the things, at least when I'm teaching my undergraduates, we just finished with Rousseau's Social Contract. And of course, many of them are interested in it. But one of the objections is, this will never work. And so that opens up the question of what did he think he was up to? What did the other authors in our course think they were up to in writing these tracts? And my hope is that they'll see at the very least that these are not blueprints for practical reform. And the value in studying them is not, do they give us answers so that we can plug into our problems today? I feel like I've done a lot of discussions in public fora about Smith, where people will ask questions, what would Smith say about Brexit? That's the sort of question that, at the very least, shouldn't be motivating our turn to the history of political thought. I think that the sort of value added that this sort of turn has is it takes us outside of ourselves. It requires that we begin to see through a new lens, perhaps a lens that we're inclined to disagree with, but one that we are compelled to try and understand from the inside. Once we have those conceptual resources, then I think things get very exciting when we do come back to our contemporary world and see these phenomena again with the benefit of the comparative clarity that we get from having studied something that's often very different. And so I think that So that's one reason why I think the canon can be useful to turn. I also think there are ways in which the canon can be problematic. And in some ways may need healthy doses of reform. But I'll say that as a, shall we say, friendly critic from within, at the very least, I think there's real benefit to at least the opportunities it provides to step outside of ourselves and then to come back to ourselves and reevaluate from a new perspective things that have become perhaps sometimes all too familiar to us.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think of this maybe in two different reasons. The case, and it's both of these are related to the canon. I mean, one way to think about the history of political thought is exactly as you say, Ryan, that it can provide a critical perspective, that it can give you a view of an epoch, to use the language from before, that's quite unlike our own, that can help us raise fundamental questions about where we've come from and where we're headed. The other way to think about the history of political thought, I think, is to think about, rather than a critical perspective, is to give us some self-understanding, that is, the sort of roots of where we've come from. So a kind of, to think of it in terms of a genealogical approach. And I tend to think, you know, the case for the canon is actually stronger on the second ground. That is, that, you know, a canon starts to look a little bit more useful if you're trying to understand yourself. That is, you're trying to understand where your world has come from. Well, it's come from these great ideas of the past that have come to form you. In the case of the critical perspective, though, I think the case for the canon is a little weaker, in the sense that, you know, you might ask the question, well, why do you always have to go back to Kant, just to pick my, because I work on Kant, you know, why do you always have to go back to this dead white guy to get critical perspective? You know, you could, we had, you know, look at an Asian thinker, look at an African thinker, something like that. I'm not sure if that helps in provoking this question about the relationship between the purpose of the history of political thought and the canon, but I too, like you, Ryan, is sort of a friendly, have some friendly critical views on it.
But except, so if I'm going to push back a little bit on the genealogical question, because we know that the canon is itself a 20th century construction, right? And the canon is constructed by people who have particular, visions, interests, many of which are springing out of their reaction to the Holocaust, right? We know that there's these ways in which these series of questions and events and people, which are meant to be our broadly construed, you know, historical origins, were put together very purposely. So I think we need to acknowledge from the outset that the canon is not a reflection of an evolution. The canon is a construction. And that doesn't make it not useful. And it doesn't make it not interesting and fascinating. And I once, for a job I didn't get, after I gave a job talk on Locke and empire, and this unmentioned person says to me, "Do you ever learn anything from the people you study, or do you have your mind made up already?" And so for him, just the fact of questioning or situating canonical figures in a historical context stopped the wonder. Like, we could not ever interact with them in a wonder way anymore because of that. I just think that's wrong. I really do. I don't see why we can't have it both ways. I mean, I've been known to burst into tears reading from Rousseau's Origins of Inequality in class because I find it so moving. And at the same time, I'm very critical of the way in which it, as a text, like Locke, tends to rely on like anthropological conceptions of native people in an empty continent that, that do conceptual work for them that they're not acknowledging, that have an impact on the way we think. I mean, the way we think about property is a constantly unfolding property has to do with Locke's understanding of what happens in America, right? So I think that we can both provincialize the canon and appreciate it at the same time. For, I think, in Ryan's sense, the kinds of questions that it elicits, the sort of imagination that it brings forward, all of that I find really, really interesting. At the same time, I think we need to be really aware of all of the political conceptions outside the canon that are being, you know, muted or obscured by it. And those are coming from all kinds of places, not just from, you know, the non-West or the global South, but from within Europe. So early 20th century radical pluralist thinkers, they don't appear in the canon of British thought. Why? Because they didn't win the fight. Because the fight in political science came down in a particular idea about the state. And so we don't talk about them. So I think being able to disclose all kinds of interesting ideas means appreciating all of the beautiful things we get from the canon, appreciating its construction as a historical object, and doing the kinds of actual genealogical works that expose and reveal other ways of thinking.
Hmm. Yeah. First, I can't resist saying that I think Jean-Jacques would have been proud by the
Oh, yeah, totally.
In the 18th century, it was Julie, the Nouvelle.
Right.
Elixir saw all the tears when they read it together. But you know, it seems to me that there might be something useful to distinguish here between the construction of the canon qua canon in terms of the great books. I mean, I'm a Chicago product, and I'm very well aware and steeped in those particular arguments for classic texts, as it were. But I think, you know, the argument for the canon doesn't necessarily stand or fall on that, because I think there's something to the genealogical point, especially when we're working at the level of conceptual issues. So it's one thing to define the canon of great books that address all the questions or most of the questions, and for some reason that gets them in there. I'm not sure I want to go to the mat on that one, but where I would want to really push, and this came up just recently, it's on the conceptual level. Just yesterday, I got a sort of an albatross around my neck off. I've been editing a volume. You both know what this process is like of doing all the work to put this together. But for years, and we've just brought together a volume that I sent off to our editors at Oxford. And it's for the Oxford Philosophical Concepts series. And I had the good fortune of editing the volume on love. And as I was writing the introduction to the volume, it struck me more powerfully than ever, having thought about questions related to love for some time, that it really is not possible to understand what Freud, Nietzsche, many other 20th century thinkers were trying to do if one doesn't really understand, at least as well as they did, what Plato and Augustine were trying to do. And so I think that's one of those places that, aside from any of the political debates on the canon, I think it's undeniable that simply to be a good scholar and to be conceptually aware of what's at stake in some of the ways we talk about things today, love very much included, it does require the history of political thought and the history of moral philosophy simply to understand how the concepts that we use today are in many ways the products of both attempts to resist, attempts to embrace, this strange melange of all of these different implications that come from putting together texts from different traditions. So I think I do warm to the genealogical idea, and I think it's helpful for that to come out. But I think it's important to see on the level of concepts individually how important that is, not simply in terms of the Robert Maynard Hutchins great books, stick them all on the shelf sort of program of the canon.
Yeah. Yeah. And I should just say, I mean, Jeannie, just to follow up on your good comments, I mean, when you think about, opening up the canon, which I think is always a good thing, in part, it's motivated by, I take it, attempts to find voices and paths that were not taken, right? That were obscured or otherwise destroyed by a sort of dominant approach. And that can be really, that sort of critical approach can be really useful, because it's imminent within our own history, within who we are. And so it's not sort of, as it were, sort of foisted on from the outside, but it's sort of internal to our own tradition. But even that, I think that sort of paths not taken still exists within a sort of a canonical tradition in the way that Ryan was just describing, so that in order to recover some of these alternative figures, one needs to understand what the mainstream figures are and what debates were and so forth. I get the sense, I don't think you would disagree with that. But
I don't agree whatsoever at all.
No. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. So there's, I mean, it's funny, as a critic of liberalism in a lot of conceptual ways, one of the things that I'm arguing for here is basically to be able to open up and be additive. And I at some point in time, that's also a critique I make of liberalism, which is that it's consistently adding and it's never actually critiquing itself. I think that there's a way that I think we can have a kind of pincer movement where we're both looking conceptually at historically about how these things came to be, and also looking in a more sort of, and I think it is that sort of wonder sense, conceptual sense of what we get from these texts, and we can look at them together again in a contrapuntal fashion that allows them to reveal things about the present that are really meaningful. And I think it means letting go of methodological purity. I mean, I think, and that's, again, to get back to, circle back to your first point, I think that's one of the things that makes political theory so interesting. It's the extent to which we are methodologically pluralist. And the way that I see scholars of a variety of different sort of orientations stepping into pools outside their expertise, because that's where the work takes them. I think that's the beauty of what we do.
Can you say just briefly, Jeannie, on the, you made that provocative point about liberalism. Maybe just say a little bit more, because I would expect liberalism to welcome actually something like the plurality and the, you know, liberation from a kind of oppressive tradition. But you see it as in the other direction.
No. I think that the multiplicity and the opening up and the plurality is great. I think what happens, there's kind of an impulse that I see sometimes within certain strains of liberalism to use that as a way to then not critique the tradition itself and to not critique the way in which power works within liberalism, to shut off and certain voices and amplify others, right? Or so if we can just... Yes, we'll welcome this move by opening everything up to multicultural voices, but then not deal with certain forms of radical inequality that we're still on under the surface there. So I and you see this a lot in empire studies, because the way that imperialism has often worked is to present itself as a kind of, I mean, the British imperialists were amazing with this, that what was amazing about Britain was that it was basically a multicultural playground, right? They said, look at all the people from all the different worlds, and we can get at once, and isn't that amazing? Yeah. And so that's the additive part I resist, not the complexity, not the multiplicity.
Yeah.
There's now that we're talking about expanding the canon and also with the questions of liberal tradition, one move within contemporary political theory that I think it's at least worth acknowledging has been the interesting resurgence of interest in what's going under the name of comparative political theory right now. And it seems to me, I as someone who does not do this, but is very excited by it, something much to be welcomed. It's not the construction of parallel canons so much as the very interesting ways in which I think some very good scholars have begun to show both similarities and differences on some key issues with different traditions. I mean, and I put that actually in a very open way deliberately, because one of the things that both excites me about, but also is potentially worrisome in what's going by comparative political theory, is how difficult it is to do that well. It's hard enough to master the language in which one is working, especially the historical vocabulary and conceptual work in which especially a thinker of the past is working. To try and do that with multiple traditions and to master them at the level of sophistication that's necessary to actually bring out. I mean, I admire and indeed am astonished by those who have the ambition and acumen to pull this off. I wish I could be like them. If the scientists figured out that I can live for 500 years, I know that learning classical Chinese and Sanskrit are high up on the list. But I recognize my own limitations and how hard it is to do that well. But my hope is that in a world that really, an academic world that praises and values interdisciplinarity to such a high degree, that this will be a strain that will continue to find ways to be encouraged so that people can develop the toolkit that that's really required to do it well. And which I can only say, I wish I had.
Yeah.
There's a fantastic book I was just looking at. Can I do a plug for it?
Yeah.
Burke Hendricks and Deborah Baumgold edited it. It's called Colonial Exchanges. And it just has this remarkable group of people. Murad Idris is in it, Inder Marwa, Jimmy Kassis-Klassen. It's just Megan Thomas. It's really, it's sort of this work in a contrapuntal vein, trying to do precisely what you're talking about, right? Which is figuring out ways to talk about these, about what we're calling comparative political theory. So,
yeah.
I think it's really exciting.
And then it connects up with those issues about cosmopolitanism and finding alternatives to cosmopolitanism. Inez Valdez's book is very good on this and in bringing out, well, you know, cosmopolitan theorists have talked about, you know, I tried to occupy a world perspective, but they've never occupied the perspective outside of a European perspective. You know, they haven't figured out what, you know, occupied the position of sort of Asian political theory, African political theory. And that's right. I think that, you know, comparative political theory offers that possibility. And as you say, Ryan, I mean, there are difficult institutional reasons that make that development more difficult and slower because, right, I mean, if you and I, we don't have the time to move outside of our areas, means our students aren't going to do that. And so it's difficult institutionally to know how to make that shift.
Although it's interesting that you put it that way, because I think student demand,
yeah,
and this speaks to a much larger issue in terms of the future of our discipline, which is, I know, one of the places we're starting. Or we started our conversation with, it's that thankfully, in the age of our otherwise perhaps to be lamented consumer university, there is still sort of a hunger for understanding and for having conceptual clarity on big questions of justice, on equality, on freedom. And this is what, to some degree, will keep us in business, at least at the universities I've been at, counting those heads in the classroom is very important for deans and appropriating lines and such things. But I also wonder, I'm getting more and more students interested in questions of comparative discussion, especially having been at universities that have a lot of Chinese national students here, people raising questions about, oh, that sounds a lot like something Confucius said. Mm-hmm. And I only know these things in translation, but they're right. And these are real. And so hopefully that this will, the influx of some students with these interests, whether they come from natural and cultural traditions or just simply their own scholarly interests, hopefully that will continue to drive, you know, I'm a Smithian, so market demand matters. But in this perspective, hopefully it will be beneficial in a good way.
I love that the market is demanding the move toward comparative. Yeah, I think that's brilliant. But I want to also say, Jeff, that it's not just that there are these parallel, I mean, in some cases, there really are discrete and parallel political traditions developing up in different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. But also, the West and the non-West have been a part of each other. Mm-hmm. For hundreds of years, because of colonialism and because of imperialism, the intersection, the encounters between the West and the non-West are part of our canonical tradition, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. They are there in Tocqueville. They are there in Mill. They are there in Kant. They're mm-hmm. there, right? And within every one of those spaces, there are also voices from within Asia and Africa and Latin America that are also articulating related and contradictory or copacetic ideas. So I think it's important not to think of it simply as comparative political theory is finding an idea in Confucian philosophy that looks something like something that Hobbes developed and then thinking about them. I think that is a totally legitimate way of approaching things. But I also think that it's important to keep that very long history of connection at the forefront of what we're doing mm-hmm. so that we don't sort of fetishize difference, but we also are really clear about connection. Mm-hmm. In fact, for me, that's the weird possibility or the weird humanist vision is that, in fact, the connection is there. The connection goes back a long ways. And at times it was exploitative. I mean, often, right? Dispossessive and exploitative, but it's there. It is part of the thing that makes the contemporary political world what it is. And dealing with that conceptually, theoretically, historically, again, is something that I think that we are well-equipped to do as political theorists.
Good. Yeah, so I wanted to move on to our last question, because time's running short here. We're You two are very busy people. I appreciate your time. The last question is about the relationship between political theory and contemporary political practice. So all of my questions have tried to elicit disagreement among us, and I've totally failed. Maybe I'll succeed. Okay, I've only mostly failed. Maybe I'll see if I'm successful here in the last one. So the question is, what's the relationship between political theory and political practice, or contemporary politics or ideology? Does political theory have a responsibility to engage in contemporary politics or to remain nonpartisan? I flipped a coin, and Ryan, you're up.
Invisible coin.
Okay, I sense that, right, no. All right, now the gloves will come off, and you'll get to see your difference, perhaps. Although I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to presume to know Jeannie's perspective on this. But so just speaking from my own perspective. So partisanship and political theory, I think at least one of the things that's come out in the course of our discussion and that I'm very conscious of in my capacity as a professional political theorist is that we wear two hats. We wear a hat as teachers and we wear a hat as researchers. And I will take the hard line and say on the first front, I don't often speak in terms of absolutes, but I'm willing for the sake of this conversation to take this line that the teacher in front of the classroom has a responsibility, and not just as a political theorist, but in other fields as well, of being decidedly, to say the least, nonpartisan. And so while I think it's natural and necessary that as engaged citizens, especially ones that study the ideas that we do, we naturally have our concerns, our first and foremost responsibility. And Adam Smith likes to talk in terms of sacred duties. I would put this right up there for us to understand that it is our mission, in fact, to encourage, develop, help our students to learn how to think, but not to tell them what to think, to use a construction that I'm certainly not the first to have used. And I'd be happy to talk more about the reasons for that, but I think that that's an important point to begin with. As far as our responsibilities in our capacities as writers, as those engaged in scholarly and in civic debate, I think there's also a very fine line to walk here. The world has more than its fair share of ideologues, and I would like to think that at our best, what we do is something considerably better than simply either repeat or repeat in a more sophisticated way lines that are already familiar through ideology. I meant what I said when I began by saying that I think that our, you know, I'll use an economics term here, our comparative advantage as political theorists is not just that we're more articulate ideologues, but that we have a capacity, or we've been trained in such a way at least, to be able to see the world differently from those who are most directly engaged in the fray. And so, well, I know that Jeannie had said some earlier things, and maybe it will be helpful if she wanted to expand on these, about some of the skepticism in terms of being able to come or occupy a fully neutral, or what Adam Smith would call, say, an impartial perspective, the old view from nowhere sort of debates that we know from Kant and Nagel on through. But I think that it is something worth aspiring to, and that at our best, I think that there are opportunities for us to be able to survey, to see, to be apart from the fray, and to be able to describe in creative new ways that define problems that are not evident to those who are most directly engaged in the partisan fight. So since, I mean, Jeff, you wanted to stir up, I took a hard line there.
Well then.
But I think certainly in our capacity as teachers, I think that we actually abandon what it is that we do if we become overtly partisan. And in our capacity as researchers, I think that sometimes we, if we do take the ideological line, we can fall short of what it is that we have uniquely to add to the conversation on civic issues as political theorists, qua theorists.
What do you think, Jeannie?
Well, I mean, I think of my political theorizing as a form of political action, not in the sense that I'm trying to influence a partisan outcome, but because I see what I do as part of a greater critical movement to disclose the way the world works in ways which are reveal new sort of non-dominated forms of knowledge and justice. And I think that has to, that at times, particularly in an utterly crazy world, which is, we do in fact all can agree we live in at the moment, where the relationship between fact and truth, between utterance and law, between what is law, where that law, and, I mean, all these questions are, it's insane. And one of the things that we are meant to do as theorists, I believe, is to help our students to actually make critical judgments about the world. And in a political environment where many people are essentially pushing back against the possibility of critical making critical judgments, pushing back against the whole idea that there is expertise, pushing back against the idea that there is actually some kind of analysis of the way the world works, I think what we can't help but be political by training people to be critical thinkers. This is the most political act we could do in a post-truth era. So that's different from partisan politics, but that is deeply political. And Edward Said, again, sorry, I got to come back to it. He had this line about no solidarity before critique, no solidarity before criticism, which means that for him, critique led. It was the thing, it was the move that opened up the possibility for people to come together in concert, that you couldn't have political action, political connection, if you didn't first have that critical moment where you opened up the world to new possibilities. And I really believe in that. And I think that at the end of the day, we can both agree, Ryan, that saying to your students, vote for Elizabeth Warren is not the road that we want to be walking down, or, you know, but at the same time, I think we can't ignore the fact that we, by teaching them to be critical, are teaching them perhaps the most disruptive political practice that you can engage in at, in our age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. And I think that...
no disagreement.
What it comes down to is, I mean, critique's a loaded word, and there's a lot built into that. But the way you just described critique is not all that different from what I described when I talked about seeing, especially the place where you ended, which is the idea that when I think of theorizing as seeing, when done well, it opens us up to the possibility that things may be quite different from what we thought before. And that certainly, it not only requires a great deal, I think, of a healthy humility, to some degree of skepticism, a realization that what things look like after we've begun to see may look very different from what we saw before, provided there is that openness on the part of the theorist. And that requires checking normative commitments at the door to be open to that. I think in many ways, even though I tried to be provocative, there may be more convergence than I thought.
Yeah. Well, let me try to throw cold water on that, Ryan, because I'm not sure if I'm convinced in this way, because, you know, your appeal to theoria, which I think is a useful way of thinking about political theory, you know, derives from a Greek word, and it's related to the theoretical life. And Jeannie, as I understood, as you were developing your approach, it has in common with the broader critical tradition in the modern age, which goes back in various places, but to Kant and Hegel and Marx. And of course, Marx is, I mean, you can see this in Kant and Hegel, but also in Marx is the a kind of a deep skepticism about the theoretical life. That is the life that's devoted towards simply seeing. You know, Marx has this line about from the thesis on Feuerbach about, not, you know, the job of the philosopher is not to understand the world, but is to change it, right? So is that the divide? I mean, okay, Is this a divide there? I'm trying to. I mean, I guess there are different ways you can put it in terms of. I mean, because one of the ways I think about maybe a divide in political theory is the aim of political theory to influence or shape the human being, or is it to influence or shape the citizen, to use the Aristotelian distinction, right? And sometimes, you know, the Straussian approach is more on the side of thinking about the good life and the role of shaping a full human life, and more the critical side is more on the side of citizenship. So I think when I think about political theory, the state of the field, I see some disagreement there on some of the final purposes, the final aims, and I think they bubble up in some ways in some of the relationships to contemporary politics. But I realize I'm trying to be provocative here. So you tell me what you think.
Can you give us an example of that, Jeff, where you see that in particular?
Nothing comes to mind off the top of my head. Well, I mean, there is a way in which there's a conservatism that's often attributed to Straussians and a more of a liberal bent to the critical theory tradition. I can't think of any particular examples when that comes to, you know, that's come to a head, but certainly that's, and of course there are lots of counterexamples to that, but it's at least, and I don't think that's simply an accident of, you know, Leo Strauss was himself conservative, or, you know, I mean, it just sort of goes to deep principles that are at stake here.
I mean, I find that some of the most interesting work out there is people doing political theory in conversation with actual politics. This gets a little bit back to what you were saying at the beginning, Ryan. So people who are working on these very, you know, important and particular ideas about representation that are coming out of the sort of Canadian discussions of Indigenous politics. Sorry, I'm going to put a plug for like, I think Michael Goodhart's sort of conception of what he's trying to actually look at political theory in a way which is systematically engaged. He calls it a bifocal effect. I don't know why I just did that for my hand gestures, but you know, the sense that you you're embedded in politics, that you understand human rights as contextual. I mean, I think there's interesting work that is coming out of these corners that are deeply political and engaged with political issues, but are also very generative of theory. So in that sense, theories, it's a more, you know, dialectical approach to theory. It both comes out of political action and political thinking, and it meets in conversation with theory from above, right? From more of a theoria type perspective. So, I don't know if that. What the hell that does to your cold water?
Warms it a bit.
I see the divide now. I mean, I think I would agree. I mean, given everything I said about real politics as the starting place, that theorizing about politics has to begin with questions of real political action. The question at the end of the day is, do we judge good political theory by whether it culminates in political action? Mm-hmm. To which I would say no. Certainly not the political action of the political theorist shouldn't be the judge by, or shouldn't be the standard by which we make that determination. And so I
agree with that.
Okay. Yeah. So then I have to double down to go even further. Jeff, you put out the terms on the table, and you were putting it in an Aristotelian sense, but the division between contemplation and action. And it seems to me that good political theory has to begin with, or I shouldn't say has to begin. I'm sure there's lots of ways good political theory could emerge. But one way that certainly I've tried to motivate my own work as a theorist is from a surveying of political action, but not one that culminates in pointing either myself or others necessarily to a path of political action. And I think there, occupying that contemplative space is endemic to what we do and requires, in many ways, a beginning with action, but a subsequent withdrawal and a comfort in standing in that position of withdrawal, speculation, and contemplation. And that's something that I think makes us very different and is sometimes hard for us to do, hard for me to do as an engaged citizen with all my own political passion.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes looks irresponsible too, right? I mean, and that's the criticism from the critical tradition, I take it, is the perspective of the contemplative life is a privileged perspective, I suppose one could say, that one can occupy that and live a good life apart from the duties of citizenship.
Except in so far, I don't see why they're mutually exclusive. I really don't. I mean, and I think this is what you're saying, right? That they're not mutually exclusive. You can have all of your investments, your civic investments, and you can also require that you have the contemplative space to do the kind of real reflection that you need to do to mount good arguments, to think critically and reflectively about the investments that you're making. I mean, am I the person in this conversation who's constantly saying you can have it both ways? Because I feel like that's what I'm saying. But I think that they're necessary for each other.
Good. Good. Well, we've come to about as close of consensus as we can get, despite my gadfly type efforts to engender some disagreement. But to both of you, Jeannie and Ryan, I just really appreciate your time. This has been a wonderful conversation. So thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. This was really fun.
You're very welcome, Jeff. Thanks very much for putting it together. Thanks, Jeannie, for being such a great interlocutor. It's really a joy to have an opportunity to do this. And kudos to you, Jeff, and congratulations for 50 episodes.
That's really exciting.
Mm-hmm. All right, well.
Are you going to collect them?
Where are they collected?
I mean, are you going to collect them and have
an edited volume.
Oh, an edited volume. Yeah, with all you had to say about edited volumes, I'm going to get right on that.
I'm now, traumatized. Did I come through? Are we off the record now?
I'm still rolling here, Ryan. So. Well, thanks again to you both.
They're great people, and I love them still.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.